May it please the court, my name is Alunit Cohen and I represent the claimant who has recently relocated to Georgia. She wanted to be here, but the doctors have stated that due to her medical condition, she could not travel. And at this time, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. My bar registration is 43634.
Thank you.
The entire premise of this case is whether Ms. Johnson, while looking up, while performing her duties as a file clerk, and by raising her arms and placing heavy files above her, if that aggravated her spinal stenosis, which eventually resulted in a fusion for her neck to become straight. And claimant's theory of the case comes from Dr. Ryan. Dr. Ryan stated that Ms. Johnson, while looking up, each time she looked up, it caused a microtrauma in her neck, and that aggravated the spinal stenosis. So the number one issue in this case, from claimant's perspective, and frankly all the other issues are going to feed into this, is that the ALJ made a factual finding that Ms. Johnson never looked up in her job duties. Now, first of all, there was no substantial evidence to do this, and that the relevant evidence is that a reasonable mind might accept as adequate to support a conclusion, and it's not substantial evidence if it is overwhelmed by other evidence and record, or if there's only a mere scintilla of evidence supporting it. Now, in this case, there was error. There were two examining doctors, claimant's doctor and respondent's doctor, both said she looked up as part of her job duties.
But counsel, didn't the doctor simply rely, especially Dr. Ryan, simply rely on the claimant's representation about her work duties?
Yes, claimant represented, but also the supervisor represented that claimant looked up as part of her job duties. The vocational expert represented that she looked up.
So was there a difference between claimant's representations about how often she looked up and the claimant supervisor's representations about how often the claimant looked up?
Actually, no, that the claimant or that the supervisor stated that she did look up, and specifically.
Well, I'm talking about the frequency of looking up. Was there a difference in that account?
The supervisor didn't specifically say how often she looked up. The supervisor said if that she was claimant's height, she would have to look up to reach the top shelves, and that she would, even on a step stool, that she would have to look up. And the ICAO specifically found that the ALJ had no record support in saying that claimant never had to look up, and the ICAO reviewed the entire record. Additionally, specifically, the ALJ said that supervisor said that she never had to look up, and supervisor specifically said, as I mentioned before, that that if she were at claimant's height, she would have to look up. So then the question becomes, is this error, which is a clear error, does it affect the entire decision? Is it harmless or not? And the answer there, of course, is that it substantially influenced the verdict and affected the fairness of the trial proceedings. And we can think of it as this way. Step one, claimant looks up as part of her job duties. Step two, that aggravates her spinal stenosis. The judge goes all the way back to step zero and says, well, she never looked up, and so it could never aggravate her spinal stenosis. And so he rules with a doctor that says, well, doesn't matter. So the issue is that he could never get to the situation of competing doctors. He could never determine which one was more relevant, because he never got to the point that claimant looked up. And
but this is a fatal flaw. Don't his factual findings contradict that theory? Didn't he get to the issue of which expert he was going to credit and made credibility findings? So why isn't it harmless under that scenario?
Because when he evaluated the two doctors, he couldn't actually make credibility findings, because he couldn't ever look at Dr. Ryan's findings. He specifically says, let me quote this, so we have this. Dr. Ryan concluded that the repetitive nature of claimant's overhead work played a large role in her development of spinal stenosis and need for surgery. He explained that claimant's job duties aggravated or accelerated her underlying spinal condition. However, a review of claimant's job duties in conjunction with the testimony of the doctors suggests that claimant's work activities do not impact the progressive development of her degenerative condition.
But why isn't that just saying, I've looked at the job duties and she doesn't look up very much?
Well, the issue is that the Dr. Ryan specifically says that every time she looks up, it causes a microtrauma.
I understand that, but we're not, we can't make findings of fact. So isn't what happened here that the ALJ said, okay, I choose to believe this expert rather than that expert? And if that's the case, what's our role as an appellate court to get in the middle of that?
I'm going to move towards some public policy here with Dr. Roth. Dr. Roth specifically states that...
That's fine, but I'd like to hear the answer to his question as well. So if you get to that quickly, that would be great.
So Dr. Roth specifically states that there is no occupational disease that can affect the spine or the neck. So the judge chooses Dr. Roth, first of all, with avoiding the reason he couldn't choose. I mean, he couldn't choose Dr. Ryan because Dr. Ryan was premised on the idea that she looked up. So because he factually found that she could never look up, he couldn't choose Dr.
But isn't that not quite true? Isn't Dr. Ryan's testimony founded on the fact that she repetitively looked up, not just she looked up once a day or once a week?
Dr. Ryan, because each time she looked up caused a microtrauma, that aggravated it. So it doesn't matter so much that it wasn't
repetitive. Well, he seemed to think it mattered, and he used the word repetitive looking up.
It's true. And, you know, claimant's testimony is that she repetitively looked up and that she was by five. She was constantly filing. As you know, in your own courtrooms, we filed.
But didn't the ALJ reject that testimony on credibility grounds?
Well, the ALJ rejected period that she looked up, and that is what was false. So the fact that he couldn't evaluate it tainted the entire course of his acknowledgement of the case. And additionally, I just wanted to say that, as you know, he chose Dr. Roth over Dr. Ryan. Dr. Roth specifically states that no occupational disease can affect the neck or the spine. Now, the legislature has already spoken on this issue. Occupational disease exists. When we do something over and over again, it can injure us. And Dr. Roth comes out and says, no such thing. No such thing as occupational disease. Now, from our idea of what we know occupational disease is, and from one ALJ crediting one doctor who specifically goes against the entire
ALJ credited more than one doctor, correct? They also credited Dr. Pitzer.
Dr. Pitzer does not deal with that argument. Dr. Pitzer specifically says that there are occupational diseases.
Right, and the ALJ relied in part on Dr. Pitzer, so he didn't rely solely on Dr. Roth, correct?
Towards the end, yes, the ALJ says, however, a review of claimant's job duties in conjunction with the testimony of Dr. Roth and Pitzer suggests that claimant's work activities do not impact the progressive development of her degenerative condition. But the argument here is that claimant could not be heard in this case. The ALJ found against every witness, every examining doctor, the supervisor, the job duties, that claimant did not have to look up. And that tainted his entire view of the case. He could not adequately examine competing doctors at this point. He didn't just find one over the other. He could not examine it because he had already made the factual finding that she couldn't look up. And he made...
But why is that true, given that the other evidence on which the ALJ relied, including the claimant supervisor, the vocational rehabilitationist expert, Dr. Pitzer and Dr. Roth, all of them assumed that the claimant had to look up at least occasionally, yet they all decided that her claim was not compensable, or at least not occupational disease, consistent with the ALJ's ultimate conclusion.
I guess I'm, can you ask?
Well, even if the ALJ had decided that she could look up occasionally, the evidence on which he relied came to the conclusion that occasional looking up did not cause the disease about which she was basing her claim.
The problem is that he didn't decide that she could occasionally look up. And if he had, then maybe he could have evaluated the competing doctors, but he didn't. He stated that she could never look up. And so he wasn't able to effectively evaluate that. There were Dr. Pitzer and Dr. Ross said, yeah, it doesn't affect it. But Dr. Ryan says, yes, it does. And he dismissed Dr. Ryan's testimony and did not evaluate the competing interests or the competition between the experts. And at this point, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
You may.
May it please the court. My name is Elliot Weiner. My registration number is 12978, and I represent the state of Colorado. I think, first off, if you look at the findings of fact in this case, the administrative law judge never says that the claimant never looked up. The claimant in her argument refers to finding 14, but if you look at finding 14 in the context of findings 13, 14, and 25, what you see is that the administrative law judge in findings 13 and 14 is summarizing the testimony of the supervisor, Helen Baum, and that becomes apparent again if you look at finding 25. In finding 25, he summarizes basically what he found in findings 13 through 17, where he's talking about the testimony of Helen Baum and then the testimony of the vocational rehabilitation specialist. He also summarized Pat Engdahl, vocational rehabilitation's testimony, who determined that the claimant looked up, reached up infrequently, less than 5% of the time.
Counsel, can I take you back to finding 14 that you started with, where the ALJ says, when getting a file down from a top shelf, claimant was not required to look or reach overhead.
I'm sorry, where are you looking?
Finding 14 of the ALJ's decision that you started with, which is the basis of the appellant's notion that the ALJ found that she never had to look up. What is he summarizing there? What testimony?
I think that he is summarizing the testimony of Helen Baum. I think it's an erroneous summary of Ms. Baum's testimony.
So you agree that's an incorrect statement?
It's an incorrect statement, but he didn't make that finding. He
You don't think this is a finding of fact? You just think this is his recitation of what other people testified to?
That was an erroneous summarization of what the testimony was, but it's harmless error.
Well, is that so? So you're saying it was error? This was an erroneous finding of fact?
No, but it wasn't his finding of fact. It was an erroneous summary of what the witness testified to.
Thank you.
What Helen Baum said was that she didn't have to look up, but since the claimant was 4 inches shorter than her, that the claimant would have to look up very infrequently to get to the top shelf. But the issue here, Your Honors, is not whether the claimant looked up at all or whether the claimant looked up infrequently or less than 5% of the time. The ALJ's conclusion here is based on the opinions of Drs. Roth and Drs. Pitzer, and he found that those opinions were more persuasive than Dr. Ryan's in determining that the claimant's work activities did not cause, aggravate, or accelerate her genetic degenerative process. Dr. Pitzer opined that looking up and working overhead doesn't cause axial loading of the cervical spine. It's in direct contradiction to what Dr. Ryan said, and the ALJ simply credited Dr. Pitzer over Dr. Ryan. It's a factual determination. The same thing was true of Dr. Roth. I would also point out that in the ALJ's findings, he found that Helen Baum had reviewed the vocational rehabilitation's report and found that this description of the vocational rehabilitation specialist report was accurate. That was the report that talked about looking up infrequently or less than 5% of the time. Further, Dr. Roth testified that even if you credited the claimant's testimony here and her job description, those job duties still do not rise to the type of activities which would cause, aggravate, or accelerate the claimant's degenerative condition. Dr. Pitzer testified to the same thing.
What did the ALJ say with respect to that particular conclusion of those experts? Anything?
What did he say?
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be like an alternative argument. I'm asking, because I don't remember from the ALJ's order, whether he addressed that particular conclusion of Dr. Roth and Dr. Pitzer.
Yes, and he found that those two opinions were more persuasive. I can read from the conclusion. As found, the medical evidence demonstrates that the claimant's job duties for the employer did not aggravate, accelerate, or combine with her pre-existing cervical spine condition to cause the need for the fusion surgery. Dr. Roth explained that the neck movement is not a traumatic event. He maintained that the events depicted in the video prepared by Ms. Hankel constitutes normal activities of daily living. He determined that to a reasonable degree of medical probability. Claimant's job activities did not cause, aggravate, or accelerate the cervical condition. The other point that was made was that somehow Dr. Roth's opinions would eliminate or do away with the occupational disease statute in the Workers' Compensation Act. That's inaccurate. The ALJ only concluded that in this case, the claimant's job duties, and the claimant failed to demonstrate by a preponderance of the evidence that her job duties would cause, aggravate, or accelerate her disease process.
But counsel, responding to that point, which I understand, doesn't it matter a great deal what the ALJ found the claimant's job duties to be? And if so, what did the ALJ find the claimant's job duties to be with respect to looking up?
I think that he found the job duties to be what Dr. Roth and Dr. Pitzer relied upon, it really didn't matter, because Dr. Roth and Pitzer, again, both testified that even if you credited the claimant's description of her job duties, that would not have medically caused, aggravated, or accelerated her disease process.
So just to make sure I understand what you're saying, even if we credited the claimant's testimony that she frequently or repetitively had to look up, that could not lead to occupational disease, that's what the expert said?
That's what both experts said, yes, Your Honor. The claimant said that Dr. Roth's testimony would eliminate occupational disease under the Colorado Workers' Compensation Act, and that mischaracterizes his testimony. What Dr. Roth testified to was, and I quote, "I would never state that there was no occupational exposure that does not matter. I would have to look at that on an individual case, but certainly in this case, I'm not seeing any occupational disease of any degree that I believe played any significance in her disease at this point in her life." So again, Dr. Roth is only addressing this case. The ALJ is only addressing this case. We're not talking about some global elimination of the occupational disease statute. There were a couple of other issues that were addressed in the claimant's brief. One had to do with judicial admission. So I'd like to address that shortly, if I may. It would be the respondent's contention that there was no judicial admission in this case. This was a case in which the lay testimony was presented at the hearing, and all the additional testimony, expert testimony, was presented by post-hearing evidentiary deposition. Prior to taking testimony at the hearing, the claimant objected to the introduction of the vocational rehabilitation specialist report and a video that she had made. And claimant contends the counsel made a judicial admission with regard to the video. What claimant's counsel said was, "Ms. Engdahl's deposition is going to be taken later, and I have a foundation objection to that document and to the video that accompanies it. And I don't know if it's going to be submitted now or not." The response that I made was that I did not intend to submit the video. And I would submit that, taken in context, the intent of that statement was to say that that there was no intention to submit the video at the time of the hearing.
But didn't the testimony or the deposition testimony go further? I don't know if you were the counsel below or not.
Yes.
Didn't you go further and say, after you said I don't intend to submit the video, period, mm-hmm. you went on to explain how you might get the document in through the deposition?
Well, I think it was at best ambiguous, but it was certainly not a judicial admission. It was not a deliberate admission on to exclude the video or to indicate that we would not be submitting the video at the time of the Engdahl deposition. This was clarified at Dr. Roth's deposition prior to the time that we took Engdahl's deposition and that the video was introduced. I think the most important point here is that when the video was introduced, there was never an objection on the part of the claimant that it couldn't be submitted and that there had been a judicial admission that it was not going to be submitted. There was a foundation objection, there was an accuracy objection, but at no time did the claimant object to the video coming in based on the fact that it should be excluded under a theory of judicial admission. The claimant, as the panel points out, submitted a position statement. It was never raised. The claimant submitted rebuttal testimony, and in fact, she addressed that issue to a certain degree. The other argument the claimant made had to do with the authority, the medical and scientific authority that was relied on by Drs. Roth and Pitzer. I would simply submit that that was a factual determination. The fact that OSHA or a federal agency may not have agreed with that authority, again, that's a factual call for the administrative law judge. He found that the authority and the opinions of Dr. Roth and Pitzer were more persuasive.
Can I ask you about that those expert opinions? Is it your recollection that claimant objected to the admissibility of the expert opinions?
No.
So there were arguments about the weight of the opinions or how much weight the ALJ should give the opinions?
Well, I think what the claimant argued was that the opinions of Dr. Ryan were more persuasive than those of Drs. Pitzer and Roth. At no point did the claimant ever attempt to exclude those opinions. There was no Daubert hearing or anything of that nature.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you, counsel.
Is this my guess? To address the honor's concern about what the ALJ actually found, this wasn't just the ALJ crediting somebody else's testimony. And I want to reiterate that it happened that the ALJ found that she did not look up or reach overhead three different times. Once in his finding of fact, and twice actually in his conclusions of law section. And it's the conclusions of law on paragraph 7 and specifically, where he finds that initially claimant supervisor Ms. Bond testified that when claimant was retrieving a file from the top shelf of a filing cabinet, she was not required to look or reach overhead. And then he says none of claimant's other job duties, including processing mail and switchboard operation, required overhead reaching or lifting. And so that specifically is a conclusions of law section where he...
But didn't he go on in that same paragraph to end by saying, Ms. Engdahl summarized that claimant was only required to gaze or look overhead infrequently or less than 5%. Isn't that also as much of a finding of fact as the earlier statement that you read from the same paragraph?
He does state that Ms. Engdahl summarized that it was less than 5% of her total duties, but he has already stated that in his findings of fact that she never looked overhead. So he's giving this as potentially support, but the point is that he has already found in his findings of fact that she has never looked overhead, and in his conclusions of law, he credits that. So the fact that he, from the very beginning, assumes that she has never looked overhead is pervasive throughout his entire order, and so he's not able to really ever look at the competing experts. Specifically, I also wanted to mention Dr. Roth's testimony and the video. Dr. Roth mentions that he relies on the video, and he does mention that twice. The basis for my opinion is everything contained in this report, including the video. My understanding of her job is based on the video and everything. Dr. Roth never examined the client and, or the claimant, excuse me. And so he relies on how she looked up based on this video. And this video, as respondents pointed out, we argue is inadmissible because there was a judicial admission, as Judge Navarro pointed out, that specifically said, I do not plan on entering this video. And then the rest of the conversation went to a document. Additionally, claimant's counsel objected at the hearing and then objected at post-hearing deposition of Patricia Engtel when she was discussing the video, and he specifically, the claimant's counsel.
On what grounds did claimant's counsel object?
On foundation.
So if that's the only grounds on which counsel or claimant objected, why should we consider this different ground of judicial admission?
Two reasons, Your Honor. First, the judicial admission, claimant's counsel objected on foundation a second time, but the first time was already judicial admission. He assumed that the judicial admission was already a supreme waiver to the court of going into that.
Why should we assume that? Did he ever say anything like that?
Well, the judge, by respondent's counsel stating that he was not going to enter the video to the court, claimant assumed rightly that the judge was not going to enter that because the respondents had already stated that he wouldn't. The additional objections had to go towards other things, including that the fact that the video was, the person who was portrayed in the video was 7.5 inches taller than
just to finish this point, you say the additional objections. Was there ever any objection made on the basis that additional admission had been made?
Not a second objection.
Was there ever a first objection on the basis that additional admission had been made?
The original objection was to foundation, and then respondents admitted that they would not be entering the video. It was not necessary that they continue to make that objection after the respondents had already stated that to the court that they would not be entering the video.
But the first objection was based on a foundation, correct?
Correct. But that doesn't change that the respondent specifically stated to the court that they would not be admitting the video. And
so
the claimant relied on
that statement.
You would
think that claimant's counsel thought that there was additional admission. As soon as the next time the videotape was offered, they would have said, objection, judicial admission. But that's not what happened, right?
No, the objection was made on foundation, and it was a valid objection at that time.
All right, thank you, counsel. I want to thank both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and the opinion will issue in due course.